dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Banner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. U.S. Election Day is 2 days away, and the coming week is sure to bring momentous news of some kind, news that will be old news by the time many of you hear this show. So my challenge was to try to bring you something that will remain relevant in the face of the various possible scenarios that could play out in the coming week. Chances are, if you're like most Americans, you have at your house some poorly made tools and appliances that will soon break if they haven't already. They were advertised, of course, as fine products at a good value. A lie. If you're over a certain age, you may remember when the basic model of anything was built to last and to be repaired. When my father died a bit more than 20 years ago, I inherited his skill jigsaw. The saw was already at least 15 years old at that time. I still have it, and it still works. If you buy a skill tool today, it will be a piece of junk right out of the box. This might seem tangential to the news of the day, but I think it's not. These poorly made items are emblematic of a culture of waste and fraud, a kleptocracy, a crapocracy, wasting resources and wasting lives. Who made the decision to have a society like this? It was never on any ballot, and it certainly doesn't represent the will of the people. We've heard about the wonderful capitalist free market that responds to what you, the customer, demands. What is the truth of that? Consider the latest corporate welfare recipients queuing up at the U.S. taxpayer bailout window, the repetitively bankrupt car makers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. To blame, they say, are those greedy workers who demand to be paid decent wages and benefits, or those people insisting on environmental laws, or those useless pensioners with all their medical bills who haven't had the decency to know when to kick the bucket. Everybody is to blame except for the management, which has refused for decades to make a fuel-efficient, well-made automobile at any price, resulting in the defection of their customers to foreign cars. These corporations have a long history of malfeasance, sabotaging mass transit, releasing products they knew were unsafe, and teaming up with their pals at the oil companies to pollute the planet and screw the people. Shall they be bailed out by the American taxpayers, or shall they receive the corporate death sentence? Bankruptcy. This week, you are the jury. You will hear the case of Who Killed the Electric Car. It's an award-winning documentary film released in 2006 that I've adapted for radio. Who Killed the Electric Car? Written and directed by Chris Payne.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are gathered here today to bereave the loss of something dear to us. We are here today to say goodbye to a special friend. to say goodbye to an idea. Some might say that to be here gathered today to mourn the loss of a car would be going too far.
In 1996, electric cars began to appear on roads all over California. They were quiet and fast, produced no exhaust, and ran without gasoline. 10 years later, these futuristic cars were almost entirely gone. What happened? Why should we be haunted by the ghost of the electric car? This wasn't the first time the electric car was killed. 100 years ago, there were more electrics on the road than there were gas cars. For many people, electric cars were the car of choice. They were quiet and smooth and could be charged at home. Gas cars, by comparison, required cranking and produced exhaust.
Phyllis Diller.
Well, the reason I am here, I'm so old, I remember electric cars when they were around in the beginning. I would have been about 6 years old on the way to the symphony in that darling little electric car.
They were very quiet,
and it had beveled glass windows. It was almost like sitting inside of a huge lamp.
What happened? Why did the gas car win over the electric car?
As the 20th century gathered speed, the electric car lost momentum. Automatic starters, cheaper oil, and mass production gave the edge to the gasoline car. By 1920, the internal combustion engine had won the race for control of the roads, and the modern automobile age was born. Of the hundreds of millions of cars built in the 20th century, almost none were electric. They were sleek, they were fast, and they gave Americans the open road. But as time went on, their number one flaw became more apparent. Smog.
Janann Sharpless, former chairwoman, California Air Resources Board.
California has the worst air quality in the nation, and it impacts some of our largest population centers.
In my district, we have what is called the black cloud of death that hangs over the port areas and the areas surrounding the ports.
Alan Lowenthal, California State Senator.
We are seeing some tremendously debilitating effects, asthma rates, cancer rates, lung development in children, children not being allowed to play outside.
In 1989, a study found that one out of four 15 to 25-year-olds in Los Angeles County had severe lung lesions and chronic respiratory disease. In 1990, there were 41 stage one smog alerts. No matter what kind of car we drive, every gallon of gas we burn adds 19 pounds of carbon dioxide to the air. The more gas we burn, the more CO2 we create.
Paul Scott, electric vehicle driver.
If you don't do something with that CO2, if you don't sequester it, then it's going to be going up into the atmosphere, and CO2 is a global warming gas.
Wally Ripple, research engineer, AeroVironment.
I believe the problems of global warming will be far greater than the problems of Social Security or even the problems of war on terrorism.
We got the equivalent of a nuclear time bomb on our hand with global warming.
David Freeman, energy advisor, Carter administration.
If lung disease from air pollution is unimportant, if all those things don't count, we're going to be in bad trouble.
And there's a public health crisis, but we have to have incentives and we have to have alternatives.
Car companies experimented with alternatives over the years, but none of them ever seemed to make it out of the proving grounds.
I remember I was the chairman of the board of the Tennessee Valley Authority, and we were promoting the electric car back in the late 70s. I had even planned a race from Gatlinburg, Tennessee to Nashville between Paul Newman and Robert Redford, and I had it all lined up, and then I realized that we'd get a lot of national publicity, but there were no cars in the showrooms.
It would take a different kind of race to make the electric car the car of the future.
The Sunracer was a solar-powered vehicle that was developed here at AeroVironment for the purpose of winning a race.
In 1987, GM won the World Solar Challenge race in Australia with a one-of-a-kind solar-powered electric vehicle, the Sunracer. Emboldened by their success, GM CEO Roger Smith challenged the same design team to build a prototype for a practical electric car.
If we were to go full speed ahead with electric cars, the electronics had to be good enough in order to warrant that concept. And that's where the work of Alan Cocconi came in.
Now, you built the prototype for this in your garage?
Yes, well, my garage isn't quite the average garage. It's actually a pretty good machine shop and electronics lab. But yes, I built it there.
Alan Cocconi.
It's like a three-channel stereo amplifier that provides the right size sine waves and right frequency to drive the motor for all the different driving conditions. So it is a 100,000-watt stereo amplifier.
Alan's breakthrough power system helped create an electric car unlike any that had ever been driven before.
Alec Brooks, AeroVironment Chief Engineer.
Oh, they had kept this car also a secret, much better than any other Detroit secret because it was all developed out here in California. So it truly was a surprise when it was introduced to Los Angeles Auto Show.
Roger Smith, former CEO, General Motors.
This is going to represent a great step forward for people in terms of commuting to work, from work, if you don't have to go more than 120 miles a day.
John Wallace, Ford Think EV program.
Other than the jokes that we made about the wisdom of calling a vehicle the impact, it was very impressive. It was very high tech, and it had an interesting premise. That we've got this sort of Corvette electric-type car, two-seater, slick styling and all that, and that we can make a business out of it.
Well, it's interesting. I had worked with the program manager who then called me and said, would you like to be on the electric vehicle program?
John Daniels, former EV marketing director, GM.
And I said, that's fine. What do you want me to do? And he said, very simply, develop demand for electric vehicles worldwide. And I said, do you have any instructions? And he took a blank piece of paper and shoved it in front of me, and he said, no instructions, you go figure it out. And so at that point, I joined the program.
It got a lot of interest flowing in the industry, but it did something else. It caught the attention of the California Air Resources Board.
California's Air Resources Board, or CARB as it was known, saw the electric car as an opportunity to solve another problem.
Since GM had already announced that they were going to produce an electric vehicle before we even adopted the mandate, the electric vehicle technology became sort of the technology of greatest promise.
Knowing a modern electric car was now possible, California regulators took a bold and unprecedented step. They passed the zero emissions vehicle mandate. The mandate was simple. If automakers wanted to continue to sell cars in California, some of those cars would have to be vehicles with no exhaust.
They decided we're going to ramp it up. We're going to say 2% in 98, we're going to say 5% in 2001, and 10% in 2003.
For the car companies, there were only two options: comply with the law or fight it. In the end, they would do both.
The electric car is here.
The EV1 from General Motors.
The Impact prototype became the EV1, the first modern electric production car from a major U.S. car company in nearly a century. GM chose its Saturn division to market it in California and Arizona.
I bought my first Saturn at 17, and they said, do you want to come work here?
Chelsea Sexton, EV1 specialist.
So I thought, okay, it would be a good college job. I'll put myself through college this way. And turned out I love the cars more than I love what I was studying in college. And 3 years later, they announced the EV1 program, and I jumped on it. There were the 13 of us, most of whom were mid-20s, unattached, single, no kids, willing to do anything for little money. We all handled a particular geographic region. Mine started as LA, and I worked with everybody from engineers and students to celebrities.
Alexandra Paul, EV driver.
I have a picture of myself just hearing this Saturn song and just being so happy.
I had one of those early EV ones, and I used it here in the Capitol. I love the car.
Colette Devine, EV driver.
It's sort of like everything Americans want in a car. They're cool, they're fast, they're sexy. I mean, I got in the car and I felt like, ooh.
It was fairly reasonably priced. It was between $250 and $500 a month.
I haven't tried accelerating too much because there's too many cops around. I'm afraid I'll get a ticket. I'll be too excited.
Believe it or not, that sucker goes. That thing will take you down the PCH so fast you could get a ticket.
I did kind of feel like Batman, you know, that sort of like, and the way it takes off out of the cave. You know, I had this gate that opens and I go.
You get inside and the console is really near you and the lighting is beautiful.
It was quiet.
The car was so fast, it looked like it would outrun its own shadow.
Oh, it was an awesome car to drive.
It was the crest of a wave that we thought was coming in. It was the new thing that was going to, you know, change the way everybody travels.
Other car companies began to comply, often with conversions of gas cars, but with many of the same advantages of the EV1.
I'm not mechanical at all, and I love dealing with my electric car because it's so easy. I plug it in at night, and when I need to drive it, I unplug, drive it away.
They're for people who love the environment.
I said they're just for people who love cars. They're for people who have to go somewhere.
Well, this is amazing. What you do is with this electric car, Dave, you put the key in and you turn it.
Wow.
And then there's this thing on the floor called the pedal. A pedal.
The exciting thing about this is the cost of operating the car is the same as if you were driving a typical gasoline car, but the gasoline only costs 60 cents a gallon.
Going to the gas station is a hassle, believe it or not. Plugging a car in is not.
The battery that you charge at home, it gets about between 70 and 80 miles per charge, which for me is more than all the driving that I need to do in the course of a day.
People started seeing the cars on the road and getting a better understanding of what they could do. Friends and neighbors and relatives started saying, hey, that's a neat idea, you know, I should get one of those. And we started seeing the momentum building for this and the waiting lists being created for these cars.
Cut to,
I go online to look for other Toyota RAV4s, and I see Toyota RAV4 EV. And I said, what's that? Click. Wow, my whole world opened up. It's this electric vehicle. It goes, you know, 100 miles to a charge, blah, 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 blah. It's just like, I didn't know this existed. I didn't know this was a possibility. How come I don't know about this? Have you seen this on TV?
When I first tried to buy the Honda EV Plus, I drove in and I said, hey, this is a great car. I said, I'll take it. The person who was trying to sell it to us was dumbfounded. He didn't know what to do. He had never leased one before, didn't know how to do it, and it took me 6 weeks of negotiations before I was able to get the car from their hands.
There's nothing like driving a car where you realize as you're sitting in traffic, there's no pollution coming out of your tailpipe. You're just sitting there with batteries on.
By driving an electric car, what are you sparing us from?
I'm saving America, Dave. That's what I'm doing. I am saving America by driving an electric car.
Not everyone was sure that electric cars would save America. Even as GM rolled out its first batch of EV1s, there were skeptics.
Consumer acceptance and understanding has been a key issue in all of this. And what we've discovered is that people are very cautious about the electric car.
I would consider it, but I don't know. I haven't done enough research, and I don't know if they're, I don't know if they're big enough, if they're going to be strong and big and dependable.
I have to know where I can go to, like, recharge it, or what do I got to do for the battery.
People don't want a mini, tiny car that has 15-inch wheels on there. How is he going to fix that up and go around town and parade it?
While some consumers express skepticism about electric cars, California was pressured to drop the mandate. A group called Californians Against Utility Company Abuse fought a small utility surcharge to build charging stations.
And they would go to local city council meetings and say, you don't want to put in an electric vehicle charging station there. That's a waste of taxpayer money. They had this list of supporters. you know, companies like Trader Joe's and others, which you'd say, like, why would they support something like this? So the EV drivers actually got together and started writing letters to some of these people that were listed on their website as being supporters and said, do you realize what you're supporting here? And they got all these names removed from the list.
Further investigation revealed that these groups were consumer organizations in name only, funded almost exclusively by the oil industry. Oil companies also paid for editorials in national publications. They even argued that the environmental benefits of EVs were dubious.
With electric vehicles, we're going to have to shift our energy away from oil. And if we shift it to coal, there are some environmental problems that are just very disconcerting.
Right now in the United States, we're 55% coal. If you run the numbers with standard coal power plants, you don't end up with a better environmental performance. You end up with a longer tailpipe.
Well, there have been numerous studies conducted by the California Energy Commission that clearly show that electric drive is substantially more efficient and substantially less polluting, even if you get your electricity from coal-fired plants.
But the arguments against electrics did not stop there.
They even made the ridiculous argument that there was an environmental justice issue involved because they said only rich people could buy electric cars. Well, the air doesn't know a boundary between Brentwood and South L.A.
Car companies began to argue that the mandate was too strict.
We had to help with the regulations. The regulatory people knew nothing about this stuff. And we began to get the eerie feeling that we were going over a cliff. It wasn't going to be possible.
California was faced with the prospect of what do you do if the car companies don't comply? And so rather than, you know, do brinksmanship about what would happen if they didn't comply and stick with it, they started negotiating, certain flexibility in the mandate.
California compromised with the automakers, adopting a memorandum of agreement.
One of the agreements with the state was that the automakers would build and market electric vehicles in accordance with demand.
If they didn't want to build more of them, the car companies would have to make the case that there was no demand.
John Daniels, General Motors.
The person will go unnamed, but we were having a lunch in the executive dining room at the GM Tech Center one day, and just the two of us, and he leans over to me and he says, Dobbles, you know something? You're my worst enemy. And I said, why's that? And he said, well, I'm out there lobbying to show that there's no demand for electric vehicles, and you're out there proving me wrong.
We would sit down with Hal Riney or with executives from GM and make, you know, how far, how fast, how much? These are the three questions we're getting. Please put it in the advertising. It's not rocket science. And they would go back and do the exact opposite.
You know, we never saw a TV ad with an electric car scampering up the side of a hill with a good-looking man or woman draped around it. That's the way they sell cars.
How does it go without gas and air? How does it go without sparks and explosions? How does it go without gears or transmissions? How does it go, you will ask yourself. And then you will ask, how did we go so long without it? The electric car. It isn't coming. It's here.
What was the objective of these advertisements? Was it to entice consumers or to scare them away?
Our goal at GM was to make the full-functioning battery electric vehicle a commercially viable business opportunity for General Motors.
GM spokesman Dave Barthmus has worked for GM for nearly 10 years.
We spent in excess of $1 billion to drive this market, to build the market. That means award-winning advertising, developing the vehicle, developing the recharging infrastructure. And in a four-year time frame, from roughly 1996 to 2000, we were able to lease 800 EV1s.
So we started this waiting list in order to prove demand to GM. But no matter how many people we got on that list, It was never considered enough demand. Everything was anecdotal to GM.
We have heard about these long waiting lists. And frankly, we did have a list of roughly 4,000 people that raised their hands and said, you know, I would be interested in getting into an EV1 and being an EV1 lessee. We contacted each of those folks, and we whittled that list down. And when we actually got down to a point where we were able to have somebody sign on the dotted line, that list from 4,000 people shrunk to about 50.
Only recently did they finally admit that there actually was a waiting list and tried to explain it away of, by the time we explained all the limitations of the car to them, only 50 would sign up. Well, if you sincerely want to market a product, you don't start out by describing the limitations of the product.
Tom Everhart is president emeritus at Caltech. He served on GM's board of directors for 13 years.
I do not think General Motors tried hard to get the electric cars out rapidly. Now, whether the CEO of General Motors understood that, I don't know.
We had to ask permission of whoever we wanted to give a car to, and by the end, when we were low on cars, we had to write case statements. We tried to put the cars in hands of celebrities because they were, number one, the only ones that stood a chance of getting the car. The third grade science teacher didn't stand a chance. I had to write a resume for Mel Gibson and what he'd done and accomplished because the people I was talking to didn't believe that he warranted a car.
I was wondering, why do I have to fill this out, you know? You had to tell them where your birthmarks were, you know? I mean, it was everything, you know? Have you recently had a proctoscope inserted into your... Well, no. You know, you had to get really specific about a whole bunch of things.
Consumers wanted it, but they regarded it as a limited vehicle, and they expected to pay a limited price for it. And there's nothing irrational about the consumer that said that to us. That's a perfectly reasonable statement. You're giving me a vehicle that does less, I want to pay less. Okay. But unfortunately, I couldn't make it for less.
They argued things like money and they're too expensive to build, and yet they're building four a day. I mean, they were very hand-built cars with specialized components, and had they mass-marketed them, they, of course, would have come down.
As car companies made the case there was no demand, electric vehicle advocates thought they had a sympathetic ear with the appointment of environmental scientist Dr. Alan Lloyd as chairman of the California Air Resources Board.
First time I presided over that, I felt that the car companies weren't making significant effort to do it, so I felt that, well, flog them harder, flog them often. They need to do better.
For the regulation, we felt needed to be changed drastically. And there was some movement that way, but it didn't go away.
While the car companies fought the mandate in Sacramento, GM quietly closed its EV1 assembly line and began laying off its sales force.
All of a sudden, we were not only taken off the project, but taken out of the company. They started with the ones with the biggest waiting list and the most customers, and you know, the primary areas were the ones that they dismantled first. And so at the end of 2001, you know, that was it in terms of my employment with General Motors.
Studying General Motors practices over the years.
Ralph Nader.
And I don't speak for the engineers and scientists who would really have liked to have done a better job with motor vehicle technology. But the executives at the top, their motto seemed to have been going backwards into the future. And that's what they've been doing for decades.
As a veteran consumer advocate, Ralph Nader used grassroots campaigns to make cars safer and more fuel efficient. He's familiar with the tactics used by the auto industry to resist change.
There's all kinds of ways that they can bring politicians to their knees. Once the auto companies get a long lead time, then they go to work, eroding, and then when the deadline is approaching, you say, we can't do it, and there are going to be terrible consequences.
Automakers took the fight to a new level. They sued California's Air Resources Board. GM led the lawsuit, soon joined by Chrysler and several auto dealerships. As California withered under the pressure, the carmakers found a powerful new ally, the federal government. Shortly after joining the suit, the Bush administration made another announcement.
Tonight I'm proposing $1.2 billion in research funding so that America can lead the world in developing clean, hydrogen-powered automobiles.
The federal government joined the car and oil industries to embrace a new clean car of the future. With more than $1 billion federal dollars up for grabs, Over the next few years, the campaign for hydrogen fuel cell vehicles began to sway California.
Hello there, and welcome to the California Fuel Cell Partnership, where we're fueling the future in a new and environmentally friendly way. Automakers, energy and technology providers, along with government agencies, are voluntarily working together to commercialize the fuel cell for cars and buses. Soon you may see some of these cars cruising through your very own neighborhood.
We will not just dream about the hydrogen fueling stations. We will not just dream about the hydrogen cars. We will build it.
The hydrogen Hummer is not a production vehicle. It's a concept vehicle. It's a way for Governor Schwarzenegger to have a property at various events that he goes to when he unveils a new hydrogen refueling station at LAX, for example.
I'm going to encourage the building of a hydrogen highway to take us to the environmental future.
While hydrogen fuel cells offered an exciting alternative sometime in the future, what would happen to the technology of today? What would happen to the electric car? It all came down to a decisive meeting at California's Air Resources Board. Citizens and industry alike testified as CARB prepared to vote on the fate of the electric car.
I'd also like to thank all the other stakeholders, particularly also the auto industry, who is going to also have a major impact here.
I like the fact that hydrogen might be in a position to displace the petroleum products.
I share your optimism on fuel cells, just not to the extent. I think it's a bait and switch strategy. I hope I'm wrong.
I'm concerned that we've picked numbers that are based entirely on fuel cells. What if fuel cells don't work?
It seems that most of the recent changes to the mandate have been designed to ease the burden on the automakers. You're part of the Environmental Protection Agency, not the Corporate Profit Protection Agency.
I think that we've been a contributor to this marketplace, too.
I agree. But remember, there are many of you. We just had, when I was giving more time to the auto manufacturers.
Lou Browning, I think, had the job to present the EPRI report, and he had been promised 10 minutes.
One of the things we found is...
I would appreciate if you could summarize this in 3 minutes.
Okay, I thought I had 10, but... Alan Lloyd cut him off, whereas he had given the automakers sort of unlimited time earlier in the day.
And the improvements we need in fuel cells are to get, mainly to get the cost down.
In addition, we've recently certified and introduced the Honda FCX fuel cell vehicle.
Largely, this work is being pushed forward through the California Fuel Cell Partnership, which has been very valuable in pulling together the diverse interests.
Any new information on batteries that sort of didn't mesh with the overall conclusions was really just shut out very fast by Alan Lloyd.
Let's get it clear. I'm not trying to show any bias or anything here.
And there were 80 people who came to speak for electric cars and only two industry representatives on the side to kill the mandate.
We have four people out of 78 who are supporting this proposal. How did we end up with this?
This is a tough, tough program. It's a revolutionary program. It pushes the automakers hard, and they don't like it, and they push back hard. And as you deliberate today on the fate of this program, I urge you to summon all of your political courage to make the hard choices that you know you need to make on this program. Because when it comes to protecting the health of the people of California, there are simply no more easy choices to make.
April 24th, 2003. California killed its electric car mandate.
I saw this as losing this wonderful opportunity that we had really invested a great deal in the infrastructure, in the technology. It was like the rug was pulled out.
They gave it away. And it, to me, that's just sad. It's a sad commentary on the way our society and our system in the United States works.
ABC News Report, June 2003.
When GM introduced the EV1, California was setting the toughest auto pollution standards in the nation. 10% of all cars sold here this year were to be zero-emission vehicles. But California dropped those standards after being sued by automakers.
But a lot of the vehicles, the Honda vehicles, the General Motors vehicles, were all leased, and nobody had the option to buy. So the automakers took advantage of that and pulled all the cars off the road. They weren't willing to let people take the cars and actually drive them and keep driving them like normal cars.
I tell you, when I noticed that GM was losing interest was when I wanted to release my car and they wouldn't let me.
I've never had a product I've had to beg and fight and cajole and persist so much to get, and then had to try and beg and fight and find any way possible to try and keep.
Well,
they didn't give me an option to buy.
They said, thank you for leasing the car.
Turn it in by such and such a date or you're going to be held liable.
GM had very quietly gone about taking cars back without anybody saying very much other than some of the drivers that complained about having their cars taken away, but never in a big organized fashion. So they had no choice but to turn them in or, you know, face the legal consequences of basically stealing a car. To my knowledge, all the cars were turned in because people had too much to lose. To this day, the automakers have fought anyone actually understanding how much demand there was and how much demand that there is.
And so we decided we were going to fight them in whatever way we could, and we became organizers.
Across California, drivers held protests to save electric cars.
I turned my head around about electric cars, and it broke me of my addiction to oil.
Unable to change policy, activists staged a funeral to raise public awareness. It was the same month as the first Stage 1 smog alert in Southern California in 5 years.
I was an EV1 driver, still am, from 1998 until December of this year when GM will have to pry it out of my charger's dead cold hands.
What the detractors and the critics of electric vehicles have been saying for years is true. The electric vehicle is not for everybody. Given the limited range, it can only meet the needs of 90% of the population.
People used to ask me, why do you do what you do? And I, especially after I had my son, told them, I figure if I do my job well enough, my son will never know a time before there were electric cars on the road. And he rode in an EV1 on the way over here, and he said, I wish we could keep the EV1 for a long time. And all I could say was, me too.
By the summer of 2004, there was only a single EV1 left in private hands in Southern California.
Today is D-Day. Today is the end.
GM did do it right. They did create a great, great car. It's well engineered, it's well designed, and it's enjoyable to drive. I've never seen a company be so cannibalistic about its own product before. It's such an odd experience.
Hey, you got here just in time.
I know, I see that.
So sad. This is the EV specialist I was talking about, who gave me her car.
Completely sad, heartbroken. Are you kidding me? They're my babies, every one of them.
With no more electric cars on the road, General Motors now had possession of their entire EV1 fleet. Why did they want them back? What were they going to do with these cars?
We had discovered 78 EV1s parked in the back parking lot of a facility that GM owns in Burbank.
But taking off the cars that were on the road, that were running fine, just let those people drive those cars until they can't drive them anymore.
Where are you guys from?
We're members of the EV1 Club. And we want to come and take a look at our cars. I know they're being mothballed here.
Yeah, I have no authorization for you guys to come back there and look at the cars.
Can we just go and, like...
No.
There were no clues as to where the cars were going until a rumor surfaced on the Internet.
We had the understanding through back channels that these vehicles were about to be taken to the Arizona Proving Grounds.
Many EV1s had apparently been trucked out of state to GM's vast proving grounds in Mesa, Arizona.
So large, and it has the track denoted on.
The location was off limits to the public, and there was no way of knowing where the EV1s might be.
Flying over GM.
Filmmaker Chris Payne took a helicopter to find the cars on the GM proving grounds.
There they are. Wow.
We
we flew over at General Motors, and looking down, we could see right next to the racetrack where the EV1 was first tested, we saw, I don't know, maybe 50 EV1s crushed and put on top of semi-flatbeds right next to the yellow crusher. General Motors is almost finished off, I think. I don't imagine there's very many EV1s left that haven't been crushed out. It's pretty sad.
GM lied about the fate of the cars.
They're one of four things that will happen with the EV1s. They'll go to colleges and universities, engineering schools. They'll go to museums and other displays across the country. Other EV1 vehicles are being driven by our engineers, and the other option for the EV1s at the end of their life is recycling. But know that every part of the EV1 is going to be recycled, dismantled through a third party, and then reused. Everything is going to be recycled. We're not just going to crush it and send it off to a landfill.
Jim Boyd, former officer, Air Resources Board.
When I saw the picture of the pile of crushed cars, it hurt, and I thought it was pretty spiteful.
Iris and Sanford of Shinsky, developers of the EV1 battery.
To see on the, on the computer, on the internet, the crushed EV1s that GM did.
It was wrong.
Tragic.
It was wrong, but more wrong is the reasons for it.
All of a sudden, we were sort of left at odds. You know, what do we do now? And at the time that most of this was going on, no one had any idea that every automaker was going to jump ship.
More internet tips revealed that the EV1s were not the only electric vehicles in jeopardy. A number of Ford Thinks and Ranger electric trucks were discovered in Palm Springs and rumored to be set for destruction. In Los Angeles, activists spotted a truckload of Toyota RAV4 EVs. Fearing the destination was a crushing facility, they chased it. The next morning, the truck turned back.
That guy was going as fast as he possibly could in a big transport like that, trying to lose us, it was clear, but wasn't able to do it. And of course, that did change Toyota's plans. It was so inconsistent, they didn't know what the hell to do.
Then he goes to the end of the pier, and these two big security guards come out. They open this locked gate, the truck goes inside, and then the security guards come out and surveil us.
Somehow we ended up at this godforsaken place.
Which has everything. It has spewing smoke into the harbor that kids have to breathe. It has an oil well, and it has Toyota, which is supposed to be the greenest car company, but which is simultaneously crushing and hiding the fact that they're crushing clean RAV4 EVs instead of selling them to willing customers.
No one had seen Honda's electric cars since they were taken from customers. Then, an episode of California's Green aired on PBS.
So we're going to be able to see cars shredded today.
Absolutely.
Which is not something most of us get to see.
We shred the car, about a car a minute, 1,000 cars a day on a good day.
And what's interesting, the first thing we noticed when we drove up here, you're going to be shredding some new cars here, too. These look like perfectly good cars. Why are you shredding them up?
A little bit of a mystery, really, since I've been here the last 8 years. They bring us these cars from the dealerships, and they say that they're test cars, and they've been brought over to test various emissions, and the insurance companies won't reinsure them, so they have to watch them destroyed here.
Boy, that seems like a shame.
It's a terrible shame.
I'd like to drive off in one of these things. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the sound of a crushed automobile being shredded into a million pieces.
There's no precedent for a car company rounding up every one of a particular kind of car and crushing them as if they're afraid one might get away.
I don't think they wanted to be sure that none of them were driving around the streets anymore to remind people that there is such a thing as an electric car.
People keep making all these analogies about, you know, crushing the EV is a betrayal of the American dream. It's not a dream. I mean, it's here now. It may be a betrayal of my dream, but it's a betrayal of the American reality.
After the discovery of the crushed EV1s in Arizona, electric car drivers took action. They vowed to keep watch over the remaining EV1s being stored at the GM facility in Burbank.
There are about 70 cars left in California. They're in the parking lot behind me, and they have plans to crush those as well. And we need to make a call to action on General Motors to give them back. You know, we ended up rallying enough troops in terms of interest and organizations to join our coalitions, and then simply didn't leave and stayed, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It's 6 a.m., and I've been here for an hour, part of the vigil. We're making sure that GM doesn't sneak out their cars in the back lot.
The first 2 weeks, we were pretty much ignored. It was monsoon rains, and it was kind of depressing to be out there, but at the same time, there was such a sense of mission.
I was here this morning from about 5:45 a.m., and, you know, it's pretty quiet.
Finally, on day 15, we did this announcement of this offer.
As the EV activist recorded the VIN numbers of the cars in storage, Chelsea led a last-ditch effort to buy the cars from GM.
Okay, General Motors contends that no one wants these EV1s here. Would anybody be willing to buy them for the residual price of the lease? And within 48 hours, over 80 people had signed up. And there were only 78 cars in that lot, and already we had a waiting list for a car that wasn't available. I mean, it was a tremendous deja vu moment.
So, at this point, we thought it would be appropriate to come full circle, join me in holding this check offering $1.9 million to General Motors to put these cars back on the road.
Despite the offer, GM did not respond. The fate of the last 78 EV1s remained in doubt. A small group of activists would continue their vigil to keep the dream of the electric car alive.
Who controls the future? Whoever has the biggest club. It's in more ways than one. One they can bash you in and one they can belong to.
Gentlemen, gentlemen! I know you're all worried, and I agree. There's plenty to be worried about, like this solar power plant.
Already operational outside Los Angeles. Photovoltaic cells. They convert sunlight directly into electricity. Fluorescent. Lasts 10 times as long as a conventional light bulb. Uses only a quarter of the power. Super windows. Insulate as well as 10 sheets of glass. An electric car, partially powered by solar panels. But the truth is, gentlemen, I'm not worried about any of these things. Because no one's ever going to know about them.
So there's all these conspiracy theories out there about who killed the electric car. So really, who killed the electric car? Well, unfortunately, I can't summarize that in one sentence.
What killed the electric vehicle, very simply, I think, is lack of corporate wisdom.
In my opinion, it's Big Oil that killed the electric car.
Alan Lloyd killed the electric car program. I was there when he did it.
The California Air Resources Board killed the electric car under huge pressure from the auto companies.
They were an accessory to the murder, but the murder was committed by the General Motors Company.
I don't believe that for a minute. GM would sell you a car that ran on pig shit if it sold.
Car makers argued that there was not enough demand for the electric car. Claiming to have spent millions of dollars on advertising, they said buyers weren't interested. But did consumers even know that the car existed?
Did you hear this? Did you ever see this car advertised or hear anything about it?
Never. That's what I'm trying to say. It's totally under the scope of the radar.
I don't know who drives an EV1, actually.
You don't know anybody?
Anybody. Maybe Fernando. I know Fernando. Fernando, did you ever drive an EV1?
I've heard of
them. He's heard of them.
They're not making those cars in California anymore?
No, they're not making them anywhere.
That's really too bad. We need those cars.
So why are they getting rid of it?
Well, they said that there's no demand for the car.
Are they insane? That's a no-brainer. Of course there's a demand.
Save gas, save people, save air, save oxygen, save the world. All sounds good to me.
We've been selling vehicles for a century, and you, as you might imagine, we sort of figured out what people wanted. If you ask them, they said, well, I want 300-mile range. I want to be able to go 85 or 90 miles an hour. And I want to carry four passengers and have a big trunk, which is basically what we were already selling.
I've said this time and time again, people will buy anything you convince them to buy. You feed people enough, and they believe that's the diet.
Consumers, they couldn't see the difference between an electric car and a car they were already driving.
Paul Roberts, author, End of Oil.
You know, because they don't read environmental impact. You know, they don't read political instability caused by oil production in the Middle East. All they read is, does this car work and how much does it cost?
Dan Neal, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Los Angeles Times.
What really killed EVs was American consumers, because they did not accept this idea, did not embrace it, vehicles could have these limited ranges and still be functional, useful, practical.
Did the electric car die because of battery technology? Did EVs really not have enough range? And did car companies use the best batteries available?
Bill Wylam, EV battery engineer, GM Delco.
Battery technology at that time was lead acid batteries and allowed the car to go 60 miles. If you started out on a trip knowing that you were going to go dead in 60 miles, you'd be nervous about making the trip.
People think that they need a car that will go 300 miles and be able to charge it up or refuel it in 5 minutes. For virtually, you know, 90, 95% of your driving, you really don't need that. You need a vehicle that will go at least 60 miles or so, and that way your daily commute is covered.
For those who wanted greater range from an EV, 100 miles or more, a better battery already existed, developed by a well-known inventor working in Troy, Michigan, about 30 miles from General Motors headquarters.
I'm standing.
And Iris Ovshinsky. I think you shouldn't do it that way. You should say you're Stan Ovshinsky, and then I'll say I'm Iris Ovshinsky. Don't do it that way. That's funny.
With over 200 patents to his name, Stan Ovshinsky had pioneered a new battery, and GM purchased controlling share of his company.
We were chosen over 60 different big companies, like Westinghouse and others, who wanted to win the race to make the batteries that would be used in pure electric cars. And we were chosen because we had a battery. And to us, putting it into a car was not the most gigantic thing. What were we supposed to do?
But you did sort of expect champagne and roses.
I expected champagne and roses. When I said that we were going to put in a paragraph into a newspaper that said we had achieved this, I really expected congratulations to flow in. And then I knew that something was different when the opposite happened.
Ovshinsky was censured for publicizing his battery advances without permission and asked not to run advertising in national publications. The EV1 debuted with a weaker battery. It would be another 2 years before Ovshinsky's batteries were installed in the EV1.
The first version of the EV1 had defective Delco batteries in them, and they kept failing. So that was GM's failure on those batteries. Once they put good batteries in, they didn't have any problems.
Ultimately, GM sold its share in Ovshinsky's company to an unlikely buyer.
Then when the nickel metal hydride batteries were improved so that they're now lasting longer than the life of the car and cheaper than an engine, Chevron Texaco stepped in and purchased control from General Motors of Ovshinsky technology. The oil companies do not feel threatened by battery technology because they effectively crushed it.
Edward Murphy, Ph.D., American Petroleum Institute.
The electric car is kind of an interesting case study. I mean, it was such an abysmal failure that I think there are a lot of people involved in the initial decision-making and pointing fingers at whose responsibility it is.
To Basra and all Iraq comes good news with the opening of a new oil field. The pipeline runs across the desert to the Persian Gulf at Fayal. There, tankers load up with the precious fuel the world needs so badly. Yes, it's a big day for Iraq, and there's a feast to celebrate. Sheep stuffed with rice and a host of other good things. But that's only the first of the good things that will come to Iraq, thanks to oil.
Oil companies have rarely shied away from global issues, but why did they lobby so hard to build public opposition to the electric car in California?
I
find it difficult to rationalize why the oil industry got so intimately involved in this, other than maybe they saw it as a threat to what I would call a monopoly they had on providing the transportation fuel.
Joseph Rahm, Ph.D., Director, Center for Energy and Climate Solutions.
There's no question that people who control the marketplace today, the oil companies, have a strong incentive to discourage alternatives, except the alternatives that they themselves control. And, you know, just as General Motors 40, 50 years ago bought up the trolley systems and shut them down, the oil companies have opposed the creation of an electric infrastructure.
I differ strongly with that. We did not kill the electric car. The petroleum industry did not kill the electric car. What killed the electric car was antiquated technology. It's a good example, and it's something that we should not repeat, an example that we need to avoid.
There's still roughly a trillion barrels worth of oil in the Earth's crust. And if you figure that the average price of that subsequent oil will be $100 a barrel, that's $100 trillion worth of business yet to be done. However, at some point, when an alternative is good enough, people will snap over. And that's what the oil companies fear the most.
We use 280 million gallons of gasoline a week in California. Right now, the price is $2.20. Well, a year ago, it was $1.20. Okay, there's a dollar more a gallon. Somebody's making $280 million more a week this year. It's the same gas, the same pipeline, the same refineries. The profits are outstanding.
The combined profits of ExxonMobil, Chevron Texaco, and ConocoPhillips in the year 2003, $33 billion. In 2004, $47 billion. 2005, $64 billion. In 2007, 1 year after this film was released, ExxonMobil's profits alone topped $40 billion.
What the oil companies feared is that electric vehicles would become successful 6 years from now. What the automobile companies feared was that they'd be losing money on electric vehicles in the next 6 months.
Even as car companies made electric cars, they fought them at every step. What was their motive? Why were they so determined to take them off the road?
I mean, I think in the beginning, General Motors didn't believe the car was going to catch on. I don't think they thought they'd ever have to worry about something like a conspiracy to keep it from happening. They hated the mandate. They hated it so much that they ended up not even really wanting to be in the business of EVs.
What I frankly detected was a huge resentment about being told what type of motor vehicle had to be made, and it became a fight of principle rather than one of trying to actually technologically solve the problem.
I do know that I was surprised at some of the stances they took in Sacramento in arguing. End of comment.
In a confidential 1995 memo, the American Automobile Manufacturers Association sought to hire a PR firm to manage a so-called grassroots and educational campaign to create a climate to repeal the mandate. The challenge, according to the document, was greater consumer acceptance of electric vehicles. Why would the car companies campaign so hard against their own creation?
Tom Everhart, Ph.D., former board member, General Motors.